Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
So the book is Developer's Dilemma, The Secret World of Video Game Creators, and we have Casey O'Donnell on the show with us today. So thank you, Casey, for coming on New Books and Technology.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. So one of the first things we always like to do on New Books and Technology is have the authors tell us a little bit about themselves, even before we get to the book. So give us a little bit of your background.
Sure. So I have kind of a strange background. I was a computer science major in undergrad and started doing the software development thing. I worked for Jet Propulsion Labs and then got hired by a small game company and sort of worked in the game industry for a while. But I also had a sociology minor and a women's studies minor, which meant that eventually I was destined for grad school. I was working at a game company, and then I left that game company and went to work for a company that does design automation. That's what they called it at the time. Nowadays, we'd call it like tools or tools in game development. So I was doing that, and I looked around, and I was like, wow, there's all these really interesting social interactions that happen in companies like this. And the dot-com flop was happening and the economy was breaking up, and I could kind of see those things play out in the workplace. And I was like, man, somebody really needs to study this. How would you do that? Mm-hmm. And so I found myself, going back to graduate school. I went to Rensselaer Polytech Institute in Troy, New York. And in this strange interdisciplinary program called Science and Technology Studies. And it was great. I spent 5 years there, four of which were spent at Vicarious Visions, which is this game studio in upstate New York. So that's kind of the process of how I got to where the book started.
Okay, great. So let's get into the book. So the book is Developer's Dilemma, The Secret World of Video Game Creators. Why Developer's Dilemma?
That's a good question. And it's funny because the original title of the book was actually Developers in the Mist, playing off Gorillas in the Mist. And sure. I think I even mentioned it in the book that that was partially because it's how, these game developers came to see me. I was I was their Diane Fossey or their Jane Goodall, and that was fine. That was a great way. But for some reason, people didn't like that title, and so I set about trying to find a new title. And continually in the book, there's this question of are developers going to cooperate and work together, or are they going to keep playing by the rules that the game industry has set up for them? And it became a really nice metaphor to think about it like the prisoner's dilemma. And so if you're not familiar with the prisoner's dilemma, basically you can defect and throw your teammate under the bus and have the possibility of a greater reward, or maybe you're both just hosed. Or if you cooperate, you have a more modest reward. Of course, the catch is, if you know that the optimal solution is to always cooperate, why wouldn't you defect knowing that the other person, being so nice, is going to give you that opportunity for greater gain? So that's where the title came from. And for me, it was this tension for so many game developers, right? Like, so many issues come up in the world. Worlds of game developers, and you see people start cooperating and trying to make headway on an issue. And so in the book, it was quality of life was one of those things, and finding a more sustainable work-life balance, and all it takes is a new console cycle to get developers to throw one another under the bus. And so that's where the title came from, was this question of, well, what would a more open and cooperative and collaborative game industry look like?
So is Developer's Dilemma kind of and the Prisoner's Dilemma kind of like Saw, right? The various iterations of that movie.
Yes, exactly. yeah, well, you know, to what ends will you go to be the one who has access to the shiny tech, or, you know, not to win per se, because it's life, it's not a game. Right. But developers certainly, you know, anytime, just like a physicist looks at the world and sees physics, game developers often look at the world and see games. So,
I want to ask you about the research choices you made. You chose to do an ethnography of video game designers, developers. And why did you choose ethnography?
That's a really great question. I think what I like most about ethnography is that you get a richness of data, and you get to ask kinds of questions and tell stories that get lost in surveys, or get lost in this emphasis, increasingly an emphasis on big data and analytics, and everything about ethnography. There's a ton of data, but it's very much about highlighting individual comments, individual experiences, and trying to tie those things to broader phenomenon in the world. Trying to show what it's like for the everyday person in a given community, and point to the interesting things that you see there. So it's, in some ways, it's the opposite side of the coin to where I see a lot of emphasis placed now in terms of big data analytics, and so ethnography is spending a lot of time and getting to know a community of people and trying to tell a story that speaks to broader issues.
Sure. So one of the things that I've found enjoyable about the book, the whole book is enjoyable. Just
thank you.
It's a foundational thing. But one of the things I found enjoyable about the book is the creativity you're able to use. So you split it into worlds and rants and you know, big boss levels and those kinds of things, you know, reminding us, those of us who play games or still play games, of the games, basically. And, yeah. And tell us about the choice to do those things and whether or not it was, like, accepted by the publisher in the first place.
Well, that's a really great question, because one of the things that I tell graduate students out there who are, you know, recent PhDs who are thinking about writing books is, don't do what I did, which is, there are so many weird things about the book. And in part, for me, it was really important that the book be playful, because my informants were unplayful, or my informants were playful. And the game industry is this kind of weird, goofy, playful space. You know, despite all of the idiosyncrasies, it really is kind of playful. And so I really felt that the book needed to speak to that. And so for me, I kind of always envisioned, you know, these worlds and this metaphor of Super Mario Brothers. And, you know, I wanted to be able to also write both in a scholarly way, but also in a way that was accessible, or even spoke to the things that I knew game developers would want to read about themselves. As far as the publisher, MIT is great for putting up with me and such a weird book. And I hope that people come to it and see it as a playful kind of entry. I read a lot of op-eds about, well, wouldn't it be great if academic writing were a little bit goofier? And but then when you go and try to do it, it's really challenging. And you know, it's easy for a more senior scholar to say, hey, we should be accessible and playful. And for somebody like myself going to do the first book, it was terrifying. And, you know, there were a couple of other publishers that were decided not to go after the book because of its strangeness.
Well, I think that's their loss. One of the other things, you know, you just mentioned is that you wrote in such a way that you thought video game developers themselves would perhaps like to see themselves or the structure of the book. And so the question is, who did you write the book for? Who did you think your audience for the book would be?
That's a great question. I think I really wrote it for three audiences. Mm-hmm. One was for scholars. You know, it is an academic text, and so I definitely viewed people interested in science and technology or people interested in games. I wrote it for them. But I also wrote it for game developers. They tend to be a pretty introspective crowd. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for years they've been writing and reading postmortems in what used to be the Game Developer magazine, but now on sites like Gamma Sutra. And so it's clear that they like to read about themselves. And so I wanted them, developers, to be an audience. But I also wanted anybody who's interested in, for lack of a better metaphor, how the sausage gets made. Right, so somebody that's really interested in games but has never really thought about the fact that games are people. And so I wrote it for those people as well, sort of that moment of, oh, wow, people make games? Because so often, you know, games disappear, or the people behind games disappear behind, you know, big names like Electronic Arts, Activision, and so allowing the people behind games to be visible again was a really important part of why I wrote the book.
Absolutely. And, you know, you talk about the disappearing developers in the book. And I wanted to know if you could talk about that phenomenon. You just started to mention the fact that there are perhaps hundreds of developers working on various games at various times, but they're anonymous. We don't know who those people are. And you talk about that in the book. Please talk about that now.
Yeah. That was a big part of it for me. You know, and in some ways it's changed a little bit, you know, because this book is really from, you know, 2004 to 2008. And one of the things that I think has changed significantly is, you know, the number of developers that are active on Twitter, for example. And so you can actually find more developers than you used to. But for every developer who's active on Twitter, there's probably 20 or more that aren't. Mm-hmm. And some of them are active on Twitter because they've had to become so, because they're either freelancers or indie. And so there's still a lot of people who aren't visible behind these things. And part of that motivation was probably selfish. When I was working on games, I felt a little bit invisible. And so the desire to make those things more obvious, I think you can point to a lot of industries or jobs, and people kind of don't understand what goes into the day-to-day of work. I mean, we all do it. We go to work and we perform lots of mundane activities that, you know, were never famous for, but they're just as critical as the things that people are known for. And so that was a big part of even what first attracted me to graduate school in the first place, was the invisibility of, you know, your everyday run-of-the-mill tech worker.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the book, you talk about video game development, but you also talk about the need for to differentiate between video game development and software development. And I think most people conflate the two, right? So how are they?
Heck yeah. So a funny story is an early essay that I wrote that sort of came from some of this material. One of the blind peer reviews that essay got, the reviewer said something along the lines of, isn't this just software studies? Isn't this just software? And, you know, why is this research even novel? And I thought to myself, well, that's a really good question. And it also made me really mad. So I actually wrote a whole essay, which is published as a chapter in this collected volume. But the name of that essay is called "This Is Not a Software Industry." And for me, it has a great deal to do with the composition of the kinds of people working. I mean, you know, even on web development, you have artists and programmers and designers, you know, so I'm sure that there's quite a variety of people that work on software. But game development really mashes together in this really intense way artists, game designers, and software engineers. Mm-hmm. In a way that if you just think of it as software, you're not allowing the artists and the game designers to have be on a level playing field, right? Suddenly it's just the work that the software engineers are doing that's important. And if you look at any game engine, you know, so Unreal is out there and that's software, but it doesn't make a game, right? Mm-hmm. It takes all of this in labor and collaboration and artwork and ideas about game mechanics and system design and all of that stuff to really make a game. And so to say it's software sort of just erases, you know, 2/3 of the kinds of creative activity that goes into games.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is a great transition because in your book you talk about, and one of the focuses is about collaborative practice, the entire practice of getting a game from its inception to, you know, ship it is one of the terms you use. So collaborative practice, what does that, you know, mean for video game development?
Collaborative practice is really about trying to understand another human being that maybe has a different way of understanding the problem or the world or whatever you're working on. Mm-hmm. And it's actually really hard to listen to somebody and try to understand what they're trying to do and to translate between that and your understanding of how a thing works or what a thing is supposed to be. And so collaboration really occurs at those friction points between, you know, so an artist looks at the world and sees it one way and they look at the problems they encounter in game development and they see it from their perspective. And an engineer, a software engineer, sees a very different world and they speak different languages and collaboration is about them figuring out how, not just figuring out, but appreciating how the other person sees the world so that they can bridge those gaps. And, you know, I talk a little bit in the book about tools engineers and technical artists as being these sort of hybrid intermediary people that have emerged, you know, at those friction points. But collaborative practice is ultimately about being good at listening and understanding and trying to it's about listening, understanding, and trying to really appreciate where somebody else is coming from, even though you may not know exactly where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about myth for a second. You know, we're talking about the kind of people who do work on video game development, but I think in popular culture, the idea is that it's mostly men, mostly young white guys working in video game development, and they're all like nerd programmer stereotype. And yet you talk about, you know, it's not just the programmers, but also the artists and the designers. So what does the myth of the video game developer mean for actual video game development?
You know, and like most myths or stereotypes, there are certainly a heck of a lot of white, nerdy people that work in games, and you know, and that's okay too. I think battling the myth of what game development is probably, I hope. One of the major contributions that this book can make, because that would be my phone. Because there is a mythology of what game development is. When I worked in games, my grandmother, you know, and now I'm a game academic, and so my grandmother says it even more often, which is, well, do you play games all day? And it's like, no, this is actual work. And it's hard work, and we solve interesting and hard problems. and the myth of the myth of the stereotypical game developer, I think, limits the number of people interested in making games, right? If all you have is this white, male, nerdy person as the sole person, the sole identity of who makes games, you know, if that's not you, you're not going to be interested in it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, once you start to say, well, hey, there are artists, and there are different kinds of artists, and there are audio people, and there are design people, and, you know, some of them have bands on the side. I mean, they're creative people. And so they're not just defined by, you know, a lot of them do like games or are interested in video games, but, you know, a lot of them are interested in atypical things, right? You know, so sports or, you know, normal things, and, you know, that game developers are people too, and normal people at that, and people that want to have families and want to do normal people things is an important part of what I'm trying to say in the book, is that, you know, games are people, and it can and should be more diverse. You know, diversity is something that doesn't really come up in the book, but it's something that's become very important in the game industry. You know, if I was doing the same project 4 years later, that would be a huge aspect of what's in there. You know, but I think part of the reason why, you know, there is this newfound interest in diversity amongst developers is in part because they recognize that, you know, the studios that are diverse and are interesting are doing cool and interesting things. And developers are looking at themselves and saying, hey, you know, there actually is, you know, value to more diversity and different ways of thinking. You know, and going back to that idea of collaboration, right? Like, the more different your perspective is, more than likely, the more creative it'll be as you sort of are able to bridge those boundaries of understanding. So I think the mythology of who a game developer is and what game development work is are, I think, two of the things that I was hoping to combat with the book.
Mm-hmm. And part of that stereotype of the game developer is a bit of antisocialness and then lack of social interaction. And yet you talk about in the book the importance of interactivity and the interactivity's implications for video game development.
That developers actually have to be able to talk to each other.
Yeah.
and not only that, but figure out ways to talk about really abstract ideas and systems and that's complicated and help artists understand how to translate, you know, because graphic design is one thing, but if you tell a graphic designer, okay, now we need to break apart this beautiful thing that you've made into all of these puzzle pieces so that we can put it into motion in the game, like, mm-hmm. That's a very complicated thing, and figuring out how to do that well is really hard. And interactivity is a tough one, right? We encounter it ourselves every day. You know, you get 50 emails, and do you stop writing or stop doing the thing that you're doing, or, you know, do you maybe sort of let the emails sit and wait? But, you know, in an industry that loves interactivity, right? They love to produce interactive games. And so there is this desire for work itself to be interactive like a game. And sometimes that's not what you need. Sometimes you need some peace and quiet and time to think about a problem or formulate an idea. And so that's a real tension for developers, I think, is finding the right balance between time for collaboration and time for internal slow thought about problems and issues.
Sure, and you just mentioned the need to find balance, and one of the other focus areas in the book is about the work-play balance and also quality of life. Looking at the infamous EA spouse rant, if you will, that was left on LiveJournal, but also looking at the amount of time that when it's crunch time that developers and those working in the industry have to spend at work working on these projects and the toll it may take on their quality of life or life outside of development.
Yeah. And for me, that was probably quality of life was probably one of the single biggest things that sort of moved through the game industry while I was doing this work. I did see marriages and people have arguments with significant others because they're spending so much time at work. And so that's complicated, and it's still an issue in the game industry today. And I think it goes beyond the game industry. I think there are lots of places where compulsory overtime or a culture of overtime is more common than we'd like to believe. I would say academia is probably one of those places too. It's a little bit terrifying when oftentimes I look at some of my old notes and I'm like, wow, how is that any different than where I'm working? I think as individuals get closer to the creative things that they make, right. So the distance between, especially, you know, for a rank and file game developer, you know, they can point to individual objects in a game and be like, hey, I did that. Right. So, You know, the guy that did all of the animations for Spider-Man and Spider-Man 3, you know, he could be like, look, I did all that. And so that person is very present in their work. And even though they may be invisible behind, you know, the name Spider-Man or the name Activision or whatever, there's a pride that goes with that. And you know, you do show up in the credits. And so I think as people get closer to the things that they produce and their name is more associated with them, there's a willingness to do that kind of crazy overtime. And that's not always healthy. And so again, you know, figuring out what the right balance is. And so going back to the prisoner's dilemma, you know, if everybody's fighting to get into the game industry, to work in the game industry, and no one, if you leave the office at a sensible time and nobody else does, right? Because, well, they're just so happy to be there, you know, that one person who's trying to find balance gets thrown under the bus just because, you know, other people might not be in a place in life where they're ready to make that commitment. And so, quality of life is still an issue, across creative industries. And certainly still within the game industry, but people are trying to figure out what that looks like. And it's pretty clear that, I mean, lots of research shows that, you know, spending 80 hours of a week at work doesn't really make you all that much more productive. It just means you spend more time at work. So, you know, but at the same time, you don't want to be the person who isn't there and the boss never sees, even though the boss might not be there 80 hours a week. So it's super complicated. And that actually hasn't even changed since I did the book. So
what are the changes that you've seen since the time that you were embedded in these various game development companies and now?
Yeah. Probably one of my favorite questions, because there is so much that has changed. Tools. So one of the things I talk about in the book are like, hey, let's get some tools that everybody can use. And suddenly, you know, here we are in 2015 and Unity, the game engine, is one of the major fixtures. If you go to the Game Developers Conference this year, their booth was the central booth when you first walked in the doors of the expo hall. And, you know, so tools have changed. Access to the kinds of tools necessary to make big games have changed. You know, you don't need to make a custom game engine to make a console game like you did pretty much in, you know, 2008. Sure, there were engines like Unreal out there at the time, but they were super expensive and they required tons of labor on top of, you know, this piece of software that you've paid for to even get close to making a game. Whereas now, you know, not only Unity, but you have things like Game Salad or Corona, you know, like all of these tools that are out there that anybody can go fiddle around with and try to make games with. And so that's really cool. The rise of independent or indie game development, that's crazy cool, but it's also strangely tied to the closure of a lot of mid-sized game studios. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that, you know, doesn't get talked about a great deal is how many of the big indie developers out there, some of them got their start, you know, just as hobbyists, but a lot of them got their start working for big game companies, and they learned the tools of the trade and the tricks and made the mistakes that every game developer makes. And now, you know, they've struck out on their own. And so I think one of the things that I think about a lot is in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, what will that balance be between independent game development and big studio game development? Because right now, I see a lot of the mid-sized studios closing shop and laying everybody off, and where do those people go, and what happens to the knowledge that all those people had about game development? Other things that have changed, like I mentioned previously, like talking about diversity. That's great. It's been delightful to see that emerge over the last 4 or 5 years, particularly at the Game Developers Conference. Developers finally talking about it and really trying to cultivate diversity within the industry. And not just diversity of people, but also diversity of games and the kinds of things that, you know, we look at, or the kinds of things that people look for when they look at games. Twitter has changed the landscape of game development in really strange and interesting ways, and not always good and pretty ways. As a game academic active on Twitter, I've certainly not experienced as much as some of my female colleagues have, but Twitter's been strange for the last 6 months. You know, if it hadn't been for the last 6 months, I'd be like, Twitter's amazing for game developers because they can be visible and and they can also receive death threats. So there we are.
Okay, so one of the new things that we've instituted on New Books and Technology is the elevator speech related to the book. Like, pretend that someone somehow has found themselves at this point in the interview having not listened to the earlier portion, and you want to give them like a brief summary, call it your book trailer, if you will, about the book and why they should go out and purchase it or check it out from the library or whatever the case may be. What would you say?
That's a really hard one. The elevator pitch for my book is, if you think video games are cool and interesting, or you think they're worthless, this book is about how the sausage gets made. And you should go read it, because if anything is either really important or totally worthless, it's probably worth knowing more about where it comes from.
That was a really great elevator pitch, I have to say. So Casey, what's next?
That's a really good question. I've recently finished one project that I'm writing on right now, which is about learning games, because serious games sort of came along while I was working on what would eventually become Developer's Dilemma. And when I first saw serious games was when America's Army was the poster child of serious games. And I was kind of like, yep, not going to study that right now. And but then I came back, and suddenly there were all these really, you know, interesting people doing learning games. And so I had a big project on science learning games that I'm starting to write about, and have another new project looking at science crowdsourcing games. So things like Foldit and Eterna. So I'm, you know, my research is still about game development, but game development in places that aren't the AAA game industry.
Mm-hmm. So the book is Developer's Dilemma, The Secret World of Video Game Creators. And we're so happy that Casey O'Donnell was able to come on the show and talk with us today. So thank you again, Casey.
Thank you, Jasmine, so much for having me. It was great.
No problem. So this has been New Books in Technology. Have a great week.